the fact it's still being deployed there is means that even over these sort of political objections, it's still the most profitable thing to put there. So if you're a smart investor, you should be investing in these technologies because it wins in any sort of environment.
Mm-hmm. And with the global energy transition, requires companies to not only scale quickly, but also act responsibly. How is Peak Energy embedding sustainability and climate alignment into your core strategy as you grow?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's at the core of what we, of why we do what we do. Going back to what I said in the beginning, like I see our mission as sort of taking away all the excuses. And, you know, that's one way to think about it. But it might be that, you know, we're all wrong, right? And climate change is fake, and I don't believe that. But, like, even in that situation, I still think batteries are the best, like, economically most viable technology. And no matter what you believe in terms of climate change or sustainability, the next 100 years are going to be dominated by things like AI, autonomy, robots. Already everyone has a phone in their pocket. EVs are by far the cheapest. If you look in China, for instance, like they're by far the cheapest new vehicles you can buy. And in the US, they're already pretty much on parity. I think Canada, probably Europe, like it's inevitable. These things are the most efficient next generation technology. It's going to be everywhere else. So we should be investing in these technologies. If the West does not get good at doing this in a world where we're worried about, certain countries being geopolitical rivals, you don't want those countries to have a monopoly on a foundational technology. And, you know, batteries, more so than even things like solar panels or, you know, wind or whatever, I think the only thing that kind of rivals batteries for strategic importance in the supply chain, apart from any kind of climate concerns, is semiconductors. Semiconductors are in everything. Batteries are also in everything. And if we can't make them, we can't make anything.
Mm-hmm. And could you share an example where Peak Energy had to make like a tough call or like to prioritize long-term sustainability over short-term wins?
It's a good question. We're only 2 years old. I think this is a nuance. This is a pretty nuanced thing. And I've seen two approaches of this, right? One was at Tesla. The other one was at Northvolt, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to make any, I'm just going to give you kind of what I've seen. I'll tell you kind of how I think about it. But like at Tesla, the whole mission of the company was around like, how do we get this technology out there? How do we make it better than everything else? So that there's kind of like, we didn't ever say it this way, but it was like, we want to just make this the thing that everybody wants to buy, right? Mm-hmm. Better car than anything else. You're not buying it because it's electric. You're buying it because it's better. And that was our mission. And it was in service of trying to transition transport to more sustainable methods, right? And because that was our North Star, we weren't really that focused on, like, we didn't care that much if our factories ran on green power, right? Because the idea was if you can electrify all of transport, the fact that one factory might have not the cleanest power in the world, but it's cheaper, like, it's better to electrify all transport, and then you can address that. Or it will actually just get addressed because you've transitioned, like, a huge part of the economy to this, and then it's, you know, that's some other company's problem, right? So it's, a question of, like, specialization and prioritization. Northvolt had the opposite approach. It's part of our core value proposition that we wanted to source, like, green power for our factories and things like that. We spent a lot of bandwidth thinking about those problems, and we did. Like, I think a lot of that was good work, and really, but at the end of the day, it wasn't really core to achieving that mission. And I'd sometimes wonder if we had been a bit more pragmatic about trying to make sure that our primary objective, which was like, let's build more batteries, like get them out there, electrify more applications. If Northvolt was around today, you would have a lot less geopolitical risk with respect to China. I think you would have less tariff pressure, less like, because these actions are reaction to an over concentration of a critical commodity in a country that is increasingly at odds politically with Western thought, right? And one way you alleviate that pressure is you have other alternatives to buy that from. And that's one of the things I think is important about Peak's mission. Now, all of that said, you need to have a balanced approach here. But I think if you're too dogmatic on saying every electron that comes into our factory needs to be green, that's probably bad because it's just going to make you more expensive, slower than your competition who doesn't care at all. Mm. But if you're too laissez-faire about it and say, I don't care if I buy, we don't use cobalt in our batteries, but let's say if we did, I don't care if I buy cobalt from someone who might be using child labor and really exploiting horrible practices somewhere, right? That's also a problem. That's not okay, right? Mm-hmm. So I think you have to have a bit of a pragmatic approach, but not lose sight of your ultimate objective. Because if you're too focused on trying to do everything perfectly along the way, you're gonna move too slowly and fail the longer term objective.
Oh, okay. And looking ahead, what does success look like for Peak Energy over the next 5 to 10 years? Not just in terms of business growth, but also in the impact you want to have on the climate crisis.
Yeah, I think. It's really about two things, bringing the cost down of battery storage, and deploying it as fast as we possibly can to all the places it needs to deploy. And we do that through designing a product that is both techno-economically better. So for asset owners who are a utility company or an independent power producer in the US, they can deploy this asset to the grid, and it's cheaper for them to deploy and to operate than the alternative asset. And that means that as the grid gets greener, it doesn't get more expensive, which is a critical thing, right? I think politicians and folks who are really focused on climate change undervalued how important it was for us to ensure that as we go through this transition, not too much of the economic consequence in the transition is felt by folks who probably are already struggling, right? And you see the reaction to that. No matter what you believe, I think you could be dogmatic about it and say it doesn't really matter if you're making a little less money, if the world is ended in 30 years. That's all true, sure, right? But if you're along that way, this is an addiction. There's no dictatorship in the ways we're doing this, right? There's no politician out there that can unilaterally in the West just say, well, suck it up, pay more rates. I don't care if you're unhappy. What ends up happening is if people pay too much for power, they're going to react to it, and there's going to be a backlash against green tech, right? And that's what's happening certainly in Europe. It's definitely happening in the US right now. And so I think that's why we have to hold ourselves to a higher standard and say, yeah, it's similar to what we did at Tesla. It was not okay to just build an electric car that people would buy because it was green. We had to build an electric car that people would buy. Of course, it was green. People were happy about that. But you bought it because it was a better car. I see it the same way for energy technology. We shouldn't be out there saying, pay me a green premium. Green premium is actually it's against what we should be trying to do, because it ultimately means that people, everyday people, some of who care about climate change, some of who don't, are going to pay more in their power bills. And if you do too much of that, they're gonna push back on this technology and creates a long-term vulnerability.
Mm-hmm. And with China, wanted to actually ask about this. Is China really a rivaling partner? How are you guys navigating with the whole situation between China and the U.S. regarding this?
Yeah, I was a Chinese, an economics and Chinese major in college. And it was my dream from high school when I first started learning about China. I became fascinated with the place to work and live over there. Spent some time in college, semesters abroad there, 2 semesters, and then did an internship. And then I lived in Singapore, but worked in China a ton the first 2 years out of college. And so I think China is one of my favorite places in the world to go. The people are incredible. The culture is super interesting and incredible. The history is fascinating. I think if you've never spent time over there, it's one of the most incredible places in the world. They work so hard. They're so innovative. The people are just wonderful. It breaks my heart in some ways that there is this increasing gap between China and the U.S., the country I'm from, and in some cases the West generally. And I hope that slows down. And I hope it reverses. And I think it will, because I think ultimately we're all more similar than we're different. And we're symbiotic in a lot of ways. At the same time, I recognize that there is a risk of over-concentration in these technologies, especially when there is a possibility of decoupling. And so I think the right approach here is to build a viable supply chain that can stand on its own feet. And in general, any commodity, like, you don't want to have any critical commodity in the entire world that, like, literally only has one place it can come from. Like, that's just a vulnerability. Could have a natural disaster. It doesn't have to be politically driven, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think the right thing is to diversify enough so that you have a choice to supply from, you know, China or from the US or from Europe, and, like, in these critical commodities, you don't have to have it absolutely everywhere, but you need some diversity in supply. And so that's our goal. And, like, that's the way we work with partners in China. We have really phenomenal partners in China, really great people. They're great at what they do. They're the best in the world at batteries. So we're trying to learn from them. We're trying to work with them long-term. I hope that we can build, you know, very long-term partnerships. But I would see that for kind of any commodity that we're doing, our goal should be that we can continue to purchase some of that from China. I would hope we can always do that, but that we can also build a lot at home and sort of combine these two things so that we have a diversity of supply.
Okay, that's really interesting. And last question is, so what milestones are you, like, most focused on in the near terms regarding Peak?
Yeah, so we have a pilot, our first, like, sort of customer-facing pilot coming up. We did our internal pilot demonstrator last year with our first systems. The first customer pilot is launching in just a few months. We're building it in California today. And then we have some larger customer deliveries coming in next year, but the really big ones are in 2027, so we're laser focused on that. One of the things that we want to do most, like, it's deeply core to the mission of Peak, is domestically manufacturing batteries. And we've got sort of all the pieces lined up to do domestic battery manufacturing, domestic in the U.S. Battery manufacturing, which would come online in 2027. Now, that is, like, will be very dependent on what happens in Congress that's sort of going through in the budget reconciliation process right now. There's changes to this law called the IRA that the Biden administration passed. Our factory, our battery factory, and I would argue that almost every other battery factory in the U.S., long-term depends on that legislation not being totally repealed or crippled. And where we are in the process today is that the House passed a version of the reconciliation bill that basically implements changes to the IRA, which make it impossible to build a battery factory. So it's in the Senate right now. We're working with senators and also with Congress people to try to fix these provisions so that it's not... it doesn't basically reverse the nascent industry that's just starting to form. We've only had a few years with the IRA to get these going, and building a battery factory doesn't happen overnight. It takes years. So we need some time to get this industry on its feet. And I hope that happens. I hope we can reverse some of those changes because, you know, it would sort of break my heart if we end up having to, like, build these factories in other places. I think it's really technology that we should be doing in North America.
All right. Thank you so much for that. Like, honestly, a lot of interesting stuff there, really. All I can say is thank you. Break of dawn, another train.
without the teeth, tongues like butterflies. Two moons oscillate in the sky.
Broadcasting from Burnaby Mountain, British Columbia, this is CJSF 90.1 FM.
I'm here with Ethan Clark, CEO and founder of Nations First at Web Summit Vancouver. Welcome, Ethan.
Thanks for having me.
Can you just tell me, first of all, just like a real basic rundown, what is Nations First?
So Nations First works with First Nations communities here in Canada, tokenization of their natural resources, energy, and ecosystems. So all of their biodiversity, carbon, soil, water, etc., makes it investable, manageable, governable to bridge the gap between, one, the investor, two, the actual nation itself, and three, the community, to ensure that the community and the nation own the data, have access to the data, and maintain their land rights, while the investor is able to also see the data and verify the project and how real it is.
On a really basic level, what do you mean by tokenization of resources?
So we work with different teams, environmental teams, geologist teams, different teams like that, and they gather all of the data. We put the data onto our network and verify its existence and turn it essentially into like a digital asset, so like a digital representation of all of that data.
And why is it important for you to be doing this work?
So in Canada, there's a $500 billion infrastructure gap between Indigenous and non-Indigenous peoples. And so that plays out in all areas of, housing and general like public infrastructure and things that, Indigenous people don't have access to that other non-Indigenous folks do have access to. That has left Indigenous peoples with the 73rd quality of life globally compared to, I believe it's around third for Canadians. Now, it's interesting because within First Nations land, when I say First Nations land, I mean, any sort of on reserve or recognized land by the federal government, there is almost $2 trillion worth of natural resources. And of course, across, quote unquote, Canada, but within, traditional territories, there's over $35 trillion worth of natural resources. So despite, over 271 court cases, or 272 court cases now, I believe, around Aboriginal rights and title and the rights to those minerals and those resources, and the right to actually develop those resources, we still face that major economic gap. We still have half the GDP that we should have, and so why it's important is that we're able to actually invest into our own natural resource projects, our own energy projects, while maintaining those land rights, removing the need to bring in any predatory investors, so that we can actually properly utilize those investments and those profits to reinvest back into our communities, ensuring that the community has oversight over how finances are being used, how resources are being extracted, what the impact is on the environment, on the ecosystem, to really sort of uphold that free prior informed consent that we so often hear.
You've obviously learned a lot from sort of the history of interactions, transactions, resource extraction companies and resources. How do you come to this problem specifically? Like, what motivated you to try to solve or tackle this?
So I worked previously, I was born and raised in and around Indigenous politics. My father was doing that work kind of before it was cool, when the money wasn't there, before the titles were there, and when it was really a difficult uphill battle in its very early stages. And that was the battle of the previous generation to have those rights recognized. And I, as I mentioned, over 270 court cases, you know, throughout the Supreme Court of Canada recognizing Aboriginal rights and title. Now, we know that we have rights over the land. I worked in that space and I recognized that, and it was a part of who I am. My father always told me, you're Coast Salish, you're not Canadian, you're Coast Salish. Being raised in and around that world, that was really a deep-seated person or sort of thing of who I am. And so doing that work and going to the United Nations and, whether that be at the municipal level, the provincial, the federal, or the international level, seeing all the different battles that Indigenous people were facing with the mining industry, whether that be the tough bureaucracy here in Canada, or whether that be the hired military in Latin America, we're all subject to these markets and all subject to these industries, and they've had a very negative impact on our communities in many ways. But at the same time, they do need to be extracted in some capacity. Now, we need to ensure that we're at the forefront of that, and so that was really the thing that led to me understanding the importance of these industries and looking at other technologies that I had been working with when I was working for First Nations in the mining sector, seeing what existed out there in the stakeholder engagement sides, in the investment sides. My background a little bit was actually in early crypto, and just navigating these different spaces, kind of putting my different experiences together, ultimately kind of led to the founding, I was a co-founder, being a co-founder of Nations First.
Do you feel that what you're doing with Nations First is sort of unique in this space?
No. We've seen this application of the technology in many other, places around the world. It's still somewhat early, but we're certainly not the first. Where I think we have created a lot of value and are really innovating is the actual value proposition that we've created. There's a lot of people doing tokenization for the sake of tokenization. Maybe it brings some money back to the investor, but there hasn't been a ton of real-world impact. And so this is a major infrastructure gap, a major financing gap, major economic gaps that exist that utilizing this technology can actually address and solve these on-the-ground problems. And so in that case, I think is where we are unique. But in the actual technology, there's plenty.
What do you hope can be achieved with Nations First?
The long-term plan is to really become a leader in how resources, energy projects, conservation projects are developed. We want to become the gold standard for how these projects are developed and to be really competitive. I think that there's a lot of there are resources made available to Indigenous communities, but I think it almost puts a ceiling on top of us where we're subject to, maybe Canadian or other, federal funding programs and guidelines, etc. I think where we need to really advance is becoming competitive in the markets and finding higher returns on these projects, better, more sustainable returns on these projects, and really move the markets. I think that's sort of the long-term goal. And once we're able to start doing that in the resource space, I want to take this into the real estate side and address housing gaps, address housing crises across Canada, across the U.S., and other, you know, all over the world, right? So I think these are sort of the immediate issues, even at the small scale, whether that be an artist or a small business that needs to raise some capital. This technology really has the ability to create more sustainable revenue models or funding models for, you know, whether that be Indigenous or non-Indigenous, you know, small entrepreneurs or home businesses and whatnot.
As you're saying, it can apply on so many levels, and the idea of sovereignty, whether that's as a nation or whether that's just sort of in the sense of like your own sort of personal ability to navigate in the world, that sort of fiscal independence is important, right? Like that ability to generate your own capital, your own power as a result, instead of depending on sort of either, you know, like a government program or whatever, right?
Yeah, we need to be an attractive place for money to be. That is the next phase of Indigenous sovereignty, I believe.
Great. Thanks, Ethan. And I wish you all the best with Nations First.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, British Columbia. We are diverse, independent, and yours.